the Weekly Squeak. I am Christian Chiller, speaking to you from an Airbnb in Athens, where I'm escaping the cold Berlin weather for a couple of weeks, which is unfortunately coming to an end now. It certainly is a great deal warmer than Berlin when I look at the current temperatures, and I'm not looking forward to returning. Oh well, I suppose I can't stay here forever. So I'm using my little portable recorder, and this is in the grand tradition of Southern European homes, a very noisy place, so hopefully there's not too much echo and bashing around behind me. In this weekly squeak, I cover a few tidbits that have attracted my attention from across the internet the past week, and this time mostly technology-related, not exclusively, but mostly. And then we will round up the episode with an interview with Monique Moreau that I did at Web Summit last year, where we talk for a reasonable amount of time about, I guess we could summarize it to making technology more people-focused, more usable by people, which is always something that interests me, and it was an interesting conversation. So let's get started with items from the past week. So first was an article from Ethan Liu on The Guardian, Bitcoin as Big Oil, the Next Big Environmental Fight. And this is an interesting post from Ethan, actually. It was one of the reasons, I think the main reason I stopped trading in Bitcoin was the environmental impact. It was just too great for me. But the post goes a little bit further. That's not a new conversation. The post goes a little bit further into talking about how the Bitcoin market is getting a lot of parallels to the oil industry, i.e. a market that is maybe too dominated by strong powers with their own agendas, about how maybe in a few years we're going to look back on Bitcoin as potentially damaging technology, especially to the environment, when it set out to be a complete alternative to that. So a sort of an interesting parallel looking through the lens of history about how we may look at a technology that is still sort of playing out right now. But history always provides a different perspective on that. So I recommend you have a read of that. It's, a new angle on a topic that has been discussed a few times. Up next was an article from Sinclair Target, or maybe Sinclair Target, I'm not sure, on Motherboard. The Rise and Demise of RSS. Now, I don't know. I sometimes think that the constant discussions around the demise of RSS are a little overrated. I use it. I don't know if that necessarily means maybe I have a somewhat biased opinion on the use of RSS, because I also know that when I've asked developers to implement RSS in a website, they've asked me, like, do people still use that? So maybe it's just me. But it's such a convenient way of connecting to things and making, I guess, very basic sort of API calls to a source of content. If you don't really understand how to use an API, you can use something like RSS to get a feed of posts to do things with. And I actually use RSS quite widely myself to create the Christian Chiller website, to aggregate the content that I've created in multiple places. So I use it. But this post is a little bit more about the history of RSS, how it became successful in the first place, who developed it, and kind of what went wrong along the way. And I found this interesting because it talks about where the standard split in two with RSS and Atom. And I actually work on a project and a product called Event Store, one of the jobs I have, which uses Atom feeds. So I sort of found this interesting to see where the two came from and how they come from a common situation in open source when a project forks in different directions and where the different directions end up, I guess. So whether or not you use RSS, it's an interesting sort of story and history about a technology. So it's interesting from that perspective alone. But if you are remorseful about the demise of RSS, like I am, it also can tell you maybe how an open source project should act and proceed with the way it does things to not die such a somewhat swift and ungraceful death, I guess. And this is actually important to bear in mind, because the only really viable alternatives to RSS now are curated or algorithmically defined feeds of content. So this means that we're not necessarily getting the kind of freedom of access to the content feed we used to be able to do with RSS. So we need some sort of alternative to it that is still as lacking a central kind of authority on where the content comes from in the first place. Is an interesting maybe topic to revisit in the future. And finally, in my little technology roundup was an article from the Science News by Maria Temming about robots that can follow how-to diagrams. I don't know, I'm not sure what you're necessarily expecting from that headline. Maybe the article is fairly short, to be honest with you, but alludes to a bigger report you can read. And then the image, which I think is accurate, is a set of robot arms like you would see in a factory, but kind of smaller version. I think they actually look like some I saw at a conference once. I think someone pitched them to me. They were sort of education robot arms to emulate what you would see in a factory. And they are playing a game of robot boxing. I don't know if you've seen this. It's kind of kids' game where you have two arms and the robots box each other. So somewhat ironic there. I mean, the instructions it's apparently following in this picture are not particularly complicated. So I don't know if that's the only level of instructions it can follow, or if it can now get up to more complex IKEA furniture or Lego, things like that. But this is quite interesting, and this is interesting in many ways because it also covers aspects of some of the things I've been looking at with my tech writer hat on about creating images that people can follow in it. And it's strange to think that this kind of goes full circle, that maybe we are creating images that can then be scraped by robotic services to follow the instructions too. And it also leads into something that I was researching a couple of years back and never really picked up again. Maybe this is an impetus to do so, was the aspect of a general gaming engine. We have computers that can play chess, that's existed for quite some time, and then more recently AlphaGo. But generally, and actually I should add to that, there have been a lot of cases of computers playing computer games recently, which is also quite interesting. It's sort of a different aspect to it. But generally these machines have to be taught the rules of individual games. So this takes this to a new level where you can have a general AI that you show instructions to and then it learns to play the game like that. And that is interesting / slightly scary depending on your perspective. But it's something I will keep following now. There's been a sort of leap forward in getting something like that to work. And in this week's, shall we say, and finally section, because they are two completely unrelated articles. First was, it depends sort of how you want to take this, but this is an article on The New Yorker by Isaac Chotiner with an interview from a Harvard astronomer called Avi Loeb, who's the chair of Harvard's astronomy department, who believes that there was a peculiar interstellar object recently called Oumuamua. And maybe we didn't question enough where it came from. And this is quite fascinating. And the interview is interesting because it actually gives a perspective that maybe the interviewer and the interviewee did not quite see eye to eye on the subject, or were not quite understanding each other. Because obviously whenever you have a discussion on alien objects, we will have a tendency to go to extremes. And that's actually one interesting thing that the interviewee mentioned in this post. But he still believes that this could have been a some sort of communication from an alien race, and we didn't really pay much attention to it, and maybe we missed it, and maybe it's too late. And this has always been a fascinating thing to think. I guess it relates a little bit to sort of Douglas Adams and the answer is 42 if you ask the right question sort of thing, is that, you know, we could be looking for solutions to alien life. The question is there alien life in all the wrong places and missing the questions being asked to us. Will we miss the search for alien life because of a standards problem, for example? Why do we expect that anyone can understand our transmissions and vice versa? And it's sort of somewhat concerning, I suppose, to think that we could, on all sides of humanity and unhuman life, be searching for each other, but just not understanding each other or missing unique opportunities when we just pass each other by. And it's really sobering to think about that. And yeah, finally, in the end, finally section, completely unconnected, but I just found an interesting post from Fast Company by Elizabeth Grace Saunders, a sort of New Year's related post, I guess. How to redesign your days to give you back a few extra hours every week. Maybe do search for alien life, who knows? I don't normally share these sorts of posts because there's so many, but I guess there were some in here that I've been following since November. I started my New Year's resolutions in November just to get a head start to try and give myself a bit more time this year. I don't know how well it's working yet, but I'm trying. And there are things like quitting something, limiting something, pausing something, delegating something. This is actually one that in particular that I have been doing a lot more of, and I have taken on a few people to help me with some tasks, and I highly recommend it actually. The other one I'd maybe throw to this list is something like time boxing, making sure that you always do certain tasks in a particular time and you force yourself to do it in that particular time. Otherwise, it just will never get done. And especially this applies for me for personal projects. Work is easy to get distracted by, especially if there's money involved because it's an extra incentive. But for those personal projects, you really have to force yourself to do them at a particular time. And that was my weekly roundup of news that caught my eye, from aliens to RSS or robots. Maybe the robots can go. But nicely segueing, maybe, to my interview with Monique Moreau about how we make technology that actually solves real human problems the way that real humans want them. This ties in a lot of things around ethics, or shall we say, removing bias of creators from technology to make it actually useful for the people we are designing it for. This interview actually covered a lot of bases. It starts off a little bit noisy. Again, the typical problem of interviewing people at a large conference where they put you in an interview room separated by tiny thin walls and there's always someone near to you who likes to shout a lot. And then it gets a little easier to hear about 20-30% through. So do stick with it, or fast forward if it's really bothering you to the parts where it's easier to hear, because it's a fascinating conversation.
The wonderful thing about the internet, you know, Humboldt Internet Institute Society, is that these are, you've got researchers, but you've got professors who have worked in the industry, right? And so they're not the practical, right? They're not just theoretical.
Okay, good. Yeah.
So, which is great. And so some of the people are looking at, algorithmic decision making and human rights, a really great research group. And so, anyway, I chose to work with Professor Ingolf Pernitz and his team, along with people out of Switzerland and other, David Chaum, who deals with randomized selective voting, to look at digital identity and the future of democracy. We were one of the seven winners for Advocate Europe. What is happening with democracy? What is happening with all of this tribalism, etc.? And we went for a workshop in Kiev.
Okay.
Met people who ran out of Hungary. I mean, people whose lives were...
Also, I have a lot of time for Eastern Europe. I'm going to go to... there's an Eastern European thing tonight. I was in Ukraine.
Yeah.
This month has been a bit crazy. Earlier this month. No, last month. A month ago. And it's kind of an area that I find very interesting.
Yeah.
Hungary, I have been to so-so. But I find Eastern Europe very interesting, especially the Balkans too. Mm-hmm. Serbia and Albania I also find very interesting. They're much newer, democracies this time around anyway.
That's true.
They still have a lot of problems, but it's also kind of interesting because you have a fresher slate to start with these things. It's actually interesting. Sometimes I like these conversations to just start without any prompting, so let's carry on. I was I've had interesting conversations with a lot of Portuguese people. Because there's a lot web stuff that happens here for the past couple of years. Everyone thinks, oh, Portugal must be amazing technically. And all these Portuguese people are like, no.
it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, they have a 10-year contract here, and it's like, I mean, it's also, well, one of the things, I mean, I'll put this away. One of the things that, that having been on both sides of the house, right, an enterprise business, also a nonprofit. I mean, there is this, so just to frame up, brother, a Swiss-based nonprofit, is that you see a view of the world through other lenses, right? When you're in an enterprise company, you walk the company talk, and there's not a lack of people knocking at your door and saying, hey, Chris or Monique, we need some funding. This gets into this corporate CSO, social responsibility, and so on and so forth. So you have this dialectic between enterprise companies and how they're using technology, and nonprofits, NGOs, civil societies, and so on. So you heard Sir Tim Berners-Lee yesterday talking about this whole manifesto around the web and being responsible for your data. The interesting thing is he has a big project called Solid.
Yeah, and there was, because I missed, I had to work actually last night on something else, helping out with an event, but my wife was watching it and wrote something about it, and she said that some of the initial sign-ups to this new thing he announced, they were Facebook and Google, which was interesting, because I mean, they're kind of, is it lip service? Are they serious? I don't know.
Yeah, so and that I think what you're finding now is, so taking a step back, same thing, right? But then look at the people. We'll take Google we'll just beat up on a company for a moment. They did stage a walkout, and some of them,
well, the staff did.
They staffed it, but some of them actually are saying, look, we don't want our technology to be used in such a way. So there's a lot of sort of that. If we take Apple, Tim Cook stood up and said, holy, companies with technologies that know you more than you know yourself, that's already crossing a line. Yet on that phone, there's facial recognition, right? So you have this sort of this polarities. I mean, look, I think I'll just take a step back. Refugees, I have a refugee on my board out of Berlin. I have a refugee on my
board. Oh, your board.
I heard on your door.
Board in
Berlin. This a graduate of a great school that I just think the world of Ann Cajard, around the Ready School.
Yeah. I volunteered there in the first term.
So he's a graduate.
Yeah. Oh.
So my guy's a graduate from that school, Akram. Early on. I've got the yearbook. I can choose the yearbook. Yeah, Akram.
I've got a...
Akram. Anyway, so, yeah. And so we'll just put that one aside. But, I went to Jordan in May. It was a UNHCR mission. Visited the camp. And 80% of refugees live outside the camp, just as an FYI.
Oh, really?
That people don't know. And 18% of Jordan's population is unemployed. So you have a lot of big polarity. 18. Okay. That's why they were protesting.
No.
They weren't protesting against the refugees. They were protesting against the government, saying, where's our work? It's too expensive. It's really expensive. Right? And so you have this strong, strong polarity. And so when I had a chance, and so for me, until you walk right into those shoes, everything is sort of echo. You kind of get it. You don't get it. So we had a family open their home to us. I mean, and plus we visited some families. And so they were gracious, very gracious. And one family said, look, we made a conscious choice of leaving. We want to go. And we they said, we want to go to Europe. We're Kurdish Muslims, and we're just not going to go back. So you have 10 people in their home, like you and I, and so the question is asked, there's three children, husband and wife. The question is asked to the husband, what do you miss? I miss everything. In their world, they were all living together, right? And the three children, a 14-year-old girl wants to be a dentist. The 16-year-old boy wants to be a helicopter pilot. The 8-year-old kid, I love this boy.
Flying dentist? You could combine
them. Yeah, the 16-year-old boy wants to be a helicopter pilot. The 14-year-old girl wants to be a dentist. An 8-year-old boy said, I'm 8 years old. I want to be a human rights lawyer. I'm going, whoa, where does that coming from, right? I want to defend my people. I want to do that stuff. So the father said, I miss everything. They asked the question of his wife, and she started to cry. Now, we were counseled by UNHCR. You're going to have to suck it in, because you're going to see a lot of that. So suck it in. And when she was crying, the daughter was crying. And the father could see his daughter crying. And so he's crying. So everybody was crying, you know, because this is something they woke up to, and they have to make that sort of big dip in decisions. And very kind couple. Very kind. But they really want to just start anew. Okay, that's outside the camp. Plus, we talk with people who are for Jordanians, you know, they want a vibrant community. They want to do some local work, which is also a polarity for them. You know, if you are a middle class, if you are somebody who is Christopher, comes from Syria, you happen to be an informatic guy, a programmer, you're not allowed to work.
Yeah.
In fact, you can pick tomatoes. And because they're trying to keep the jobs sacred for Jordanian citizenship. On the other hand, so we went to Satori camp, and we had a chance to go into to somebody's container. You know, they have their own now. It's their privacy. They have basic goods and everything, etc. So they were focused on the woman who had the father was her husband was holding the baby, and they met in the camp. Okay. Marriage was, by the way, it's 5 years, 10 years when you're in a camp. People don't know that. And she said, and he's really gracious to her. She said, it was love, you know, it was sort of this love, and they met. He's an Arabic scholar. They all come from the same area. They love to go back. They want to go home. And so, they got married. They had a child together. By the way, population, births are going way up. It's an interesting scenario. We were talking about that, too. They focused on her. Why? She got a scholarship. Germany, the German government, is one of the wonderful donors. Nobody talks a lot about it. Poor Germany's getting a lot of pain.
There's plenty of conversation in the country.
And she got a scholarship, so she is going outside to Al-Bayt University to study, and she wants to study dentistry. Dentistry is big. So she wants to study dentistry. And so they asked. So everything is through an Arabic translator. So one of the visitors said, well, do you speak English? And she goes, of course I speak English, but do you speak Arabic? Right? And then as the husband is holding the baby, they said, what is it that you wish for your child? And he starts to pray, said, not this. I want her to have that future. Right? And so that's something that he was very concerned about. So somebody said, look, I'd like to study Arabic, you know, do lessons in Skype, because I'll teach you free. Right. But those are the sort of the narratives that you sort of picked up and went back. We talked with UNHCR. Now you're starting to hear it a little bit because the battle's moving. They said, let's see how that works out. They said, we know that war is coming towards the Jordanian the border. What people were not talking about is the fact that 50,000 refugees are stranded in between. So they have to ferry food to them using construction trains. It's called the berm. The berm. And the border was closed at the time. I think Jordan's reopening because they have to prepare for this. The border was closed because of a suicide bomber a couple of years ago in August. And so these people, they can't go back. They're stranded. They're in between. So they were prepared. They were working with the authorities to look at how they would open the border and maybe go back to some of the camps, you know, to fill some of these camps up in the meantime. But certainly the people would like to go back home. They just really want to go back home. They really feel their courage. So, but for me, that was an interesting thing. That was insightful. That was May. Right? And so I learned a lot about, you know, what's going on in the space, about how they use biometrics to actually open up bank, you don't even have to have a bank account. What happens is we ran through it. It was really interesting technology. Basically, it's cashless. You're registered. This is the family, Christopher Ward, and they'll send you a text message and say, "Family Christopher Ward, it's time to pick up your 240 Jordanian, you know, money." And you can go and you any of these places to where you're, because your eye is actually through your retina. If you have a damaged retina, they'll do it another way. In fact, when you go to Jordan, have you visited Jordan? Everything is through your retina, by the way.
Yeah.
So, and you get the money. But what's nice is you see who the donors are.
Yeah.
Right? So, and if you don't, you're taken off the list. You don't have any money. And so, because they'll keep knocking. They'll knock, "Hey, you haven't picked up your funds yet. Are you going to pick up your funds?" Scratch family Christopher Ward out, right? Or Chris Ward. So, but it's an interesting to see what the technologies are, how technologies are enabling in this case. The thesis around the humanized internet is, you know, we did win an award, MIT Solve, around healthcare, the narrative around closing the caregiver, global caregiver, lack of caregivers globally, and could we not use credentialing? Could we not work with the refugee community to use credentialing? They don't care. Refugees don't care about blockchain. What they want to know is the British government going, or the German government going to accept that recertification, right? Because that's the most important. And why is that critical? That's because when they come, they're spending 40 to 50, this is the far right narrative, 40 to 50,000 euros trying to recertify, they can't recertify, they go on, they drain the social system. That's not what they want. So you have to kind of think about how do you solve the problem at source, right? And so that's one of the exciting things.
What do you mean? What do you mean at source? Before they leave a country, or
before they leave?
In terms of having,
if they're going to resettle, resettlement is a legal term, right? If they're not going back to Syria, if you have caregivers, 100 nurses, whatever they. Or ambulance drivers are the examples. Those are examples we've seen. And they really have made the decision mentally, culturally, to say, "We're going to go. It's no way. We don't want to stay." If they're going to go to Sweden or Australia, I was actually in Australia at the end of May, they want to be able to come in and work. They want to be able to say, "Look, I've been certified. My credentials are, we're working with the caregiver foreign nursing group, which does a bit of that credentialing, plus we're doing it with blockchain. I've been certified. Can the receiving government accept it as recertification?" Now, we know that healthcare is very, very sensitive, but at least with nursing or caregivers, it, an I'll put that in quotes, could they not accept it? That's what we mean by source. If they're going to, rather than saying, okay, sorry, you're going to have to spend another 20,000 quid, you know, to do that, right? Yeah. So,
and what is the Humanized Internet?
It's a nonprofit.
Doing, is it research? Is it implementation?
So,
or?
Oh, we've got several things. We are, we're working with groups like Procivus.ca. So the solution is in space, place when we're talking about EID Plus, right? So that exists.
Okay.
In fact, they're working with a Rohingya out of Malaysia to offer it as a solution. So that exists. That is also part of the solution that is going to be given or donated to for the Advocate Europe project. So that's not ethereal. Number one, that's a good thing. But what we're working on further is this whole notion of a persistent digital lockbox.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't exist.
Is that on a phone or?
It could be. It could be on a device. It could be on several devices where you and your family, your wife will have a digital keys and access to that has your sets of documentation there. It's persistent to you. It's not on a Google Drive.
Yeah.
Okay, so it'd be paired. You have it sort of paired. And only you. So we're not talking about storage because people say, oh, storage, it's going to go to the cloud. No, it's not. So some of the universities, technical universities, are like, this is a really interesting problem. We would like to work on it. So there is a level of research that is getting to this space.
Yeah. There's actually the, I don't know if you saw the recent HTC crypto wallet phone, and it was a stupid novelty. It hasn't even come out, but it's a stupid novelty idea. But one thing they proposed, which is reminding me of this, was that they said instead of having the standard public key, private key setup, you could give like parts of keys to your families, and then if you ever lost the phone, then HTC would. This all starts to break down a little bit, but still the idea is interesting. Recreate the records from those keys from your trusted parties, which sounds, you know, a little bit like this idea, although for its purpose was a bit strange.
Well, no, but nobody would recreate keys because only you would have them, and if they're lost, they're forever lost.
No, not the keys. It's the keys to what you've lost.
Yeah. So you don't want to depend on a sort of a centralized authority.
No, for sure. This was amongst.
But it's kind of, you know, sort of a little bit in that direction.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, when we think about this device, Rohingyas, I mean, people out of Berlin who made the walk, that was important to them. In fact, there's some research documentation to say that was my body, that phone, that device
For sure.
Is everything.
Yeah, everybody has one.
I will save money for that, right?
Yeah.
So we know that's a tool. It's just how the tool is used. It's just when we talk about digital keys and safe deposit. I mean, if I keep my documents, my original birth certificate in some kind of bank or vault or wherever that is, and it gets destroyed for natural disaster. I'm not even talking about war. I'm talking about just a bloody earthquake or something, and I don't have the original anymore. I can't get the original for whatever purpose. Then what happens?
So it's got to be a challenge.
It's
going to
be challenged
governments
to
accept
Accept it, because and I think this is where we're kind of gravitating towards or getting towards, you know, a bit. And of course, you take these government entities along the journey. Otherwise, they'll just kind of go, "Whoa, you're way off left field." So, and that's kind of the concern, because anything that's centralized will be hacked. Having said that, I think the government, I'm not sure if it's New Zealand, has basically said just on digital keys. Now they're thinking in terms of Bitcoin or that level of keying. They could demand. They will. They have said, if we suspect malfeasance, we're going to demand that you surrender them. It's like, whoa, where is that?
I think it's happening in a few places, especially because you also have encrypted conversations and things. It's a problematic. It's like
demanding a password or something, you know.
Well, you know, look, I'm not, I mean, I think that instead of hacking centralized databases, it'd be interesting. So it's Copernican, what I'm thinking about, right? So 7.4 billion people, you sort of, you're going to go and hack 7.4 billion people. You kind of flip that paradigm a bit. And if I move it forward into the narrative that I've been talking about in two panels, at least, I this gets into the future of work. So I'm going to take you along another path. Can we not use, so, you know, I'm also in this group around, we co-authored a book, a whole group of people throughout the world, people-centered economy, right?
Yeah.
You saw that. So I think I gave it to you as a URL. Could you not use, so if we think we're in a task-based economy, you know, you're in a job, you're in a company, I have the right to throw you out, but I don't have the right, I'm not going to make you whole again. I don't care. You're just a cost. Versus the gig economy, which is I've got freedom, I'm just going to supplement my income, versus the next wave, which is the people-centered economy, which is why not use artificial intelligence? This is the manifesto. Where I'm going to pair you with the perfect, your job that you want, with the people you want to work with. You are going to get more money than you are earning now. And, oh, by the way, there'll probably be some commission charge to it, but it's for you. It's called the tailored, you know, it's tailored. We're not yet there. And I think that's where we have to flip it a little bit in terms of the good use. AI right now, and I'll put that in quotes because you have to look at what AI is.
Yeah.
But right now it's kind of it's a cost rather than an earning opportunity. So flipping that conversation around to do that is really where, when you read the book, where the direction is. And so if we could do that, then you don't have to say, okay, you're a triangle and I got to put you in a circle, because the whole thing about search is so static anyway. Or, yeah, we just scrub people. And
the jobs that no one wants?
No.
That's where...
We're talking about a job for you, right? Tailored for you. But what is a job that no one wants? You know, maybe somebody wants that job, right? But, you know...
Maybe.
You
don't, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know about a job that... I mean, I think the thing of it is right now is that what happens is you'll get a knock on the door and say, oh, Chris, we think we can do this. What do you think? And you're going, well, I got about 20% of that, but that's not really... I don't know who the other side is, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's what you're doing. But I think we have to think of it at a level of, can that not be possible? And the technology is here. It's also the will of... At least one of the European commissioners went, oh, gosh, we want to talk to you about that. But this is a group of people who are saying, and they're filmmakers, they're roboticists, they're entrepreneurs. There's a group of very eclectic individuals who are saying, we can do this. It's very possible, and they're global.
And still, just to go back slightly, so the humanized internet is a set of research projects or active projects?
No, they're active. I mean, we're writing a book on it. So so the book is going to come out with some of the contributors that I've been talking about, you know, in entertainment and so on, circa March of 2019. I'd like to say it's March 2019, at least that's what we have on the website. So there is the example of taking it further. So there's there's some of the sets of projects we want to work with universities on. So there's the research aspect of it. There's a solution aspect of it. The solution we've given you. So two examples. One is, what about working with people who are doing e-government as a service, EID plus. And there is also the example of, can I use a blockchain credentialing, which is the MIT Sol project, which is concrete. And I do walk my talk. I mean, I'm finishing up a master's degree in digital currency at the University of Nicosia, which is the first university.
University of where?
Nicosia in Cyprus. It's the first university to offer this program, and where the first course is free. It's a MOOC. But then you would have to matriculate formally. And I've met incredible people, Chris. I met doctors, lawyers. You know, you have to understand law in this space. You have to understand what... I mean, I even coded. which is like, take me... When you talk about a smart contract, then you know what you're talking about when you do that. Mm-hmm. And which is really fun, you know. And so there's looking at the aspects of how do I deal with... So number one is, you know, educating yourself, being cogent in what it is you're doing. Otherwise, you're just, you're not credible, yeah. Right? Yeah. You know, to talk, sit with somebody and look at how they deal with Ethereum and smart contracting versus setting up your virtual Bitcoin mine, which is what I did, which is an interesting space in itself, you know, and understanding what's happening in that space. And then having a wallet or several wallets set up, you know, I got 0.12 cents on it or something, but you know, to be able to do that, yeah. Sort of cogently,
yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's the value. I mean, we're looking at working now to take it even further in with the Vetri or Procivus Foundation. I'm going to be leading the foundation. We're looking at this notion of creating and branding around fair data, like fair trade, responsible use of data. And so enterprise companies are realizing that this is something that they really want to get into. They, you know, just as you say, whatever Intel Inside, or this has not been built, or fair trade. I think there is an appetite. We believe, we have market research to suggest there's an appetite to get more and more into that responsible use.
Do you mean things around people monetizing their own data instead of their data being monetized? Or
yes, you choose selectively to share it and say, look, I'm going to pay me if I want to. If I want to deal with precision in medicine, knowing that DNA is really, really hard, but at least I know how it's being used and so on and so forth. I think that's important. Or I can say, I want to go to Dr. X, my general practitioner, but not Dr. Y, because I don't trust that doctor. Actually, they're doing that in Estonia. By the way, I have an Estonia card.
I do too. So I've had one for a very long time.
Which was a nice experiment, right?
I mean, I went to the Estonian Embassy in Berlin, which is a fun little place.
I actually went to Estonia to get it.
Yeah, at the time. I went afterwards. But so in some respects, maybe the project is almost better named as the human-centered internet, an internet that revolves around humans being able to maximize it as opposed to the other people maximizing them.
We trademarked it, after multiple conversations and plus some working with people-centered economy, multiple conversations, it was apparent that we really had to get back to the human being, the human in the center of this conversation. I mean, there's so many dystopian views of what technology can do, but if you just have the human, back in, the human, it's going to be, I think...
What do you think is actually needed to make some of these ideas and ideals and maybe even dreams happen? Are the current power brokers too vested? Are they only, when they sign up for some of these ideas, are they only really just doing it to look good? Or are they really changing? And conversely with that, do enough people care enough to make it happen?
Wow. Great sets of questions. I'm hoping, I'm going to use sort of the hope term. I think it's very important that the power brokers, the enterprise sides of the company, I think they're starting to get that this is a very important issue. Now, whether or not they do something about it and realistically do something about it is open. I think it's crazy that in Silicon Valley, you have tons of people who are homeless. There's no middle class.
Yeah.
I mean, my brother used to work for the city in San Jose. I mean, you know, I've been living in Switzerland for over 28 years, 5 years in between in Hong Kong. But he could take you and show you places where these people are homeless, and they're lower middle class, and some of them are veterans, military veterans. Mm-hmm. Where is that? Where's logic in that? And it doesn't matter if some companies company CEOs are saying we're going to sign checks and give it to the homeless. That's not what they want. No. They want dignity.
Yeah.
They're living, families are living out of cars.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you can turn that paradigm around where you say zero tolerance for homeless, pay people to learn, that type of thing, change that a bit, that would be a start. I think there is a fine line between mass empowerment of these technologies to mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
A very fine line, and I think the consumers are not aware of it. I mean, I could take a spider drone, probably, and not that I would, but I took the spider drone and probably put anthrax on it, and do you know that spider in your shower is a spider? You don't know. I think it's interesting that people are looking at your rucksacks for the obvious, but what about other kinds of nastiness that could happen? And I think that this is the situation. It's a fine line. Or, on the other hand, hey, I take a picture and I can diagnose my skin or whatever. I have these tools at my behest. But the consumer, I think it's important and incumbent upon all of us to actually educate that we create these technologies, and who are we, by the way? That gets into cognitive bias bias. And I think it's incumbent upon us to embed quote-unquote ethics, quote-unquote, into, and that gets into a larger set of conversations of what that is. It's very interesting that philosophy is coming back in, you know? But it's still the question. On the other side, with large enterprises, I think it's they got to show their stuff. Right? On the other side, being on the other side, we can pose this. We can actually say we create these solutions, or we pose the question such that solutions in this direction can be created. Whether or not that becomes a threat, an existential threat to these organizations, it's yet to be seen. So do they actually co-opt that and say, okay, we're going to go off and do it? Do you trust it? I mean, everything we're talking about is a loss of trust, whether it's the banking crisis or whatever, it's a loss of trust.
So good point.
How do you build trust back in?
And a lot of recent projects have talked about bringing back trust amongst people. And whether they do or not is, again, a different conversation. But that's actually a recurring theme that's come up a lot.
That's true.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for your time.
Hey, Chris, thank you.
And that was my interview with Monique Moreau from last year's Web Summit. I hope you enjoyed it. That was quite an interesting weekly squeak, I think. We covered aliens. We covered old technologies. We covered robots learning things faster than humans. I feel like there's a combination there. There's a theme there maybe we should pay heed to. Speaking of which, I actually rewatched 2001 recently, and that was an interesting film. I feel like also relates to some of those aspects. Anyway, you can find more about my other newsletters and the other podcasts I will be running soon, and the new website will be done soon. I do apologize for the past 2 weekly squeaks. I have been redirecting you to look for information. It isn't there quite yet, but just in case you're listening to this in a few weeks when it will be ready, because it will be ready very soon, I promise. You can find more on christianchiller.com, or you can tweet at me on @ChrisChinch, and you can find me as Christian Chiller pretty much everywhere else. So if you have been, and until next time, thank you for listening.